1979. When you go over there and tell those girls they're gonna catch a cold. Because brand cat food.
Tonight on our third Noirvember episode, we're talking about one of the films that I don't think it's exaggerating to say is almost universally beloved by cinephiles and film fans. Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye is a satirical adaptation of the Raymond Chandler novel of the same name, released in 1973 and becoming basically the most iconic piece of neo-noir filmmaking. Neo-noir is definitely even harder to pin down than noir as a subgenre or style of filmmaking. It's a description of films made after the 1940s and 1950s golden age that have incorporated stylistic elements of the noir genre.
Listen, what are you here for, Mom?
Well, I'm here because I'm getting ready for the big game Saturday. You know, we're playing Notre Dame, and I hope I catch a touchdown pass. So now I'm going to be a come. I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm just getting into my makeup.
Well, fags makeup. That's
you got a banjo? I do my old joke.
Sure.
However, what those can be, and even what the main genre has to be, is incredibly broad, which is already the case for noir itself. Most often, the neo-noir genre looked to subvert many of the tropes we've come to expect are noir tropes. Films as broad as Taxi Driver, Chinatown, directed by no one, Blade Runner, Reservoir Dogs, and Blue Velvet have been pointed to as examples of neo-noir. The Long Goodbye being a direct adaptation of Raymond Chandler's sixth Philip Marlowe novel, released in 1953, means that it's very easy to see why this film is neo-noir. The most famous adaptation of a Philip Marlowe novel, apart from this movie, was the 1946 Bogart and Bacall-led Howard Hawks film The Big Sleep, the second Bogie and Bacall film after the 1944 To Have and Have Not, also directed by Howard Hawks.
You know, it just happened. I had a bottle of pretty good rye in my pocket. I'd a lot rather get wet in here.
Well... like we're closed for the rest of the afternoon.
The critical and commercial success of The Big Sleep would directly lead to Dark Passage and then finally to Key Largo, which we covered last week. Bogie's version of Philip Marlowe is actually not like the Raymond Chandler one. Chandler has Philip Marlowe being far more like Cary Grant, tall, 6 feet, 190 pounds, and incredibly witty, which Bogart absolutely was as Philip Marlowe.
Detective. Didn't know they existed except in books, or else they were greasy little men snooping around hotel corridors. Ah, you're a mess, aren't you?
I'm not very tall, either. Next time I'll come on stilts, wear a white tie, and carry a tennis racket.
I doubt if even that would help.
He talks nonstop and charms and flirts in a world that's very clearly the one of World War II, since there are female taxi drivers, shopkeepers, and there are definitely more women in this one than your typical noir film shot after World War II ended. The Big Sleep is also known for having one of the most convoluted plots put on film, at least before filmmakers like David Lynch got famous for doing that on purpose. This is because Howard Hawks, William Faulkner, Jules Furthman, and Lee Brackett all took turns doing drafts of the screenplay, which was unfinished at the time shooting began.
Say, wait a minute. Who the hell are you?
Well, I'm this here private investigator who was sent here this afternoon to find you, but the good doctor here dummied up.
You were sent here to find me? Why?
Well, I'm supposed to bring you home if that's where you want to go.
Lee Brackett, three decades later, would also write the entire screenplay for Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye. Satirizing many of the elements from films like The Big Sleep and the screenplay, The Long Goodbye stars Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe, Nina Van Pallant, Sterling Hayden, Mark Riddell, Henry Gibson, David Arkin, Jim Booten, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. You'd think Elliot Gould would be a strange choice to play a role so associated with Bogart, and you'd be right about that. The casting of Elliot Gould wasn't even a purposeful choice. United Artists had a contract with him for one film left. They told Altman and Brackett, take it or leave it. Or maybe that's the story. Another one is out there that David Picker of United Artists knew Altman would direct if he selected Elliot Gould to star. Gould had been unemployed for 2 years after losing favor in Hollywood after rumors surfaced he was on drugs when he was shooting A Glimpse of a Tiger, which was scrapped after 4 days of shooting. Lee Brackett took the Philip Marlowe of the 1940s and 1950s LA and threw him into 1970s Hollywood, joking that it was a Rip Van Marlowe, as if he had gone to sleep in 1950 but woken up in 1970, where Marlowe spends most of the film ranting to himself, stumbling around, and smoking cigarette after cigarette. Marlowe is actually the only one who chain smokes in the whole film, and he drives a 1948 Lincoln Continental to really drive it home. when his client and close friend, Terry Lennox, who we really get no introduction or explanation for, shows up begging for a ride to Tijuana after getting into a fight with his wife, Sylvia, that clearly became physical. Marlo reluctantly drives him there, mumbling the whole time and complaining. The next day, Marlo is arrested for possibly being an accomplice to Sylvia's murder, till Terry Lennox also ends up dead in Tijuana of an apparent suicide. Then Philip Marlo is just let go and left to his own skill to get home.
He's a smart ass, that's what he is.
That's what I meant.
Well, why don't you learn to say what you mean?
He's a real smart ass, Lieutenant.
After seeing his write-up in the paper for his arrest, Aline Wade hires Marlo to find her missing husband, Roger Wade, a famous author struggling with severe alcoholism. The Wades also happen to be the Lennox's next-door neighbors. Elliot Gould's Philip Marlo bounces around, getting beat up for his friendship with Terry Lennox, who also owed the gangster Marty Augustine money that they believe Marlo has now. Being thrown in the middle of the Wade's terrible marriage after breaking Roger Wade out of the Dr. Verringer clinic, trying to find his lost cat that escaped when Philip Marlo went to Tijuana.
I even lost my cat.
The Lee Brackett screenplay was not loved by Robert Altman, except the ending when Marlo blows Terry Lennox, who isn't dead and who set him up, away in Tijuana. Altman began making changes, the opening, which is now iconic, where Elliot Gould repeatedly tries to trick his cat into eating something other than its favorite brand of cat food, and then goes to the store to discover they're out of the brand. Altman had heard a story about a cat who, no matter what they served, his friends could only get to eat one brand of cat food.
Hey, excuse me, I don't see any Curry brand cat food.
Some what?
Curry brand cat food. Hey, it happens to be the only kind of food. Yeah, Curry brand. C-O-U-R.
Oh, we're all of that.
Curry
Why
brand.
Why don't you get this, mister? All this shit is the same anyway.
Oh, yeah? You don't happen to have a cat by any chance,
What
do
I need a cat for? I got a girl.
This whole sequence humanizes Marlo and makes him into a delightfully pathetic figure. Altman added many now iconic moments to the screenplay, like Roger Wade's suicide and a woman getting smashed with a Coke bottle by Marty Augustine. The screenplay wasn't rigorously followed anyway. Sterling Hayden, by this point, a real-life alcoholic who was just far too drunk and high to remember lines, and most of his back and forth with Elliot Gould are just improvised. Sterling Hayden's Roger Wade's home is actually Robert Altman's home in Malibu. Altman decided not to read the novel, The Long Goodbye, and instead read Raymond Chandler Speaking, a collection of letters and essays to get to know Raymond Chandler's mind. The movie is also filled with interesting gags, such as the constant diegetic and non-diegetic use of a John Williams-produced theme, The Long Goodbye, and a second song, Hooray for Hollywood. Yoga girls chant The Long Goodbye. It plays on radios, car radios, bar pianos, in the supermarket, arranged in different ways every time. There's also pure chaos at the Los Angeles Police Department. One of the best gags involves a party photo booth taking mugshots. The camera is constantly moving throughout the whole film on a dolly. This type of what I call postmodernist filmmaking has been so replicated and repeated throughout the years.
I got a girl that loves me. She got more money than Sylvia and Augustine put together. The hell, nobody cares.
Yeah, nobody cares but me.
Well, that's you, Marlo. You'll never learn. You're a born loser.
Yeah.
Welcome to Movie Night Extravaganza. I did not get the right file, so I'm doing it live. We have Christina Oakes, a.k.a. Cosmopolitics, who hosts Christina's Corner on This Space on Tuesdays. And also, we're going to start our own This Space show soon. And Josh Dugan, the co-host of the SVU podcast, Munch by Benson, as seen recently on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and the nostalgia-driven movie podcast, Unkind Rewind, which I was on 2 months ago, I think, talking about The Sting. Was it 2 months already?
Yeah. Yeah, 2 months.
Live sound effects. I, of course, am your host and a real cutie pie, Forrest Miller.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. I wish I had the ability to like just start playing The Long Goodbye, like the theme.
Yeah,
That theme has been stuck in my head. I saw this movie 3 years ago for the first time, which okay. I know. I've seen pretty much my Altman movies kind of in drips and drops or whatever. But I watched this 3 years ago and that theme has been stuck in my head for the last 3 years. Like, I will randomly sometimes just be like, it's the long goodbye.
That's the version you're always doing?
What?
Oh. That's the version you're always doing?
Yeah. No, it's not, okay. it's not the one with the girl going, "It's the long goodbye," or the guy that
you're not doing the Mexican village.
Yeah. when they have the large coffin that they're just walking down the road with. But welcome back, Josh. You were here last month for the Love Witch. Love Witch, baby.
Yeah.
I guess starting it off with you, Josh, like, when did you first see The Long Goodbye? This is probably, I mean, I feel like to be some kind of cinephile, like to call yourself a film fan, you have to have seen this at one point.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I have to have seen this the first time. This is probably the second or third Altman movie I saw. First time I saw it would have been at least 20 years ago.
What was the first? I want to see if it's the same.
MASH, I think.
Maybe
it was The Player or Shortcuts.
First one I saw was Popeye, and I feel like
never mind. Popeye yeah, for sure.
That was like a masterpiece.
I saw it as a kid. And I was and I remember seeing Popeye, like Robin Williams' biceps, and be like, "The fuck did I just watch?"
But then like all of the rest, the non-Popeye, like I always forget that's him until I watch like a Altman retrospective, and then it's like, "Oh yeah, Popeye." But then, like in quick succession, I would
have Sidney Lumet directing The Wiz. It's like, what?
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, it would have been in quick succession, like this falling in with Cuts and MASH, you know, like those would have been late teens, early 20s views.
I feel like I had this fall in, if I remember correctly, because it was podcast related, Nashville. I kind of watched.
I still haven't seen Nashville.
Oh, Nashville is incredible. Ooh. Yeah, is like a genuine.
We did an episode on it.
I used to rent it, but it was a two-taper, and I've never even put in the two tapes. I've never put in the second tape. I've always fallen asleep during the first one, and I've rented it like four times.
God damn. What you're saying is you never saw the second half of Titanic, too, then?
No, I saw that in the theater.
So he couldn't get away, you know.
But
Nashville is incredible. You got to watch that. It's like, but it's like, you know, it's within 2 years of this, which is crazy. I think it's 75. And
Christina, you also did Hustle.
When did you see this for the first time?
Well, I remember watching Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice when I was younger, and thought he was fine. And then I discovered The Long Goodbye. Eventually, I think it was on Turner Classic Movies. Yeah.
I mean, it's like a good later Turner Classic Movies movie, right? Like, it's like, we don't usually do necessarily from this time period, but because it's, you know, it's intrinsically related to The Big Sleep, which is a movie that I saw before this. And it's so funny I went back and I watched it again for this episode. And it's so funny to compare Bogey's Philip Marlowe with the Napoleon Complex, I would call it, because he's like, Lauren Bacall is I think Lauren Bacall is an inch shorter than he is. And then in scenes where she's clearly wearing heels, she's taller than he is. So it flips. In some scenes, he's shorter, but he's wearing like this giant fedora. And so that version is so different than Elliot Gould, who's like 6'3". So all this stuff about Marlowe being described by Raymond Chandler, like Raymond Chandler, obviously by the end of it, because he wrote 6 Marlowe books, I'm pretty sure. And by the end of it,
They were supposed to do like some sequels in like the 90s something like that, but they never got to. But also, I forgot Elliot Gould was married to Barbara Streisand and they have a son together. I forgot about that little tidbit. This is post divorce.
Elliot Gould. Their kid is the one who throws the party in Say Anything, right? Isn't that Barbara Streisand and Elliot Gould's kid?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
It's funny that, I can reference it because Conan's not here, so he's not going to go. I've never seen it before, but like I got stuck watching Friends with family members, and it's so funny that they had Elliot Gould cast as Ross's dad in Friends, and like it was very like a generation of people watching 90s sitcoms, I guess, and was like, "Oh, look, it's Elliot Gould. He's a dad now." And it's like his personal style is so, I mean, especially now, is so like he dresses like a character from A Serious Man or something like that.
He definitely morphed into like they're two different Elliot Goulds, you know. There's like pre-1980 or so Elliot Gould, and then there's post-1980 Elliot Gould.
Well, it makes perfect sense when you when you learn the backstory to some of this stuff, where it's like, this is Elliot Gould's almost like Dennis Hopper phase, where he literally got to a point where he was too fucked up on a film set and they canceled filming after a couple weeks of filming. And like, because they were like, oh, this guy is on drugs. And like, the story isn't straight about whether he really was or not. I mean, maybe he wasn't, he was just kind of like nuts, but he kind of had a breakdown, and then for 2 years he couldn't get any work. And if he hadn't been rediscovered, I mean, that's the story of a lot of different actors, I guess, but like, if he hadn't been re-employed for this, which no one can even tell the actual story. Like, I don't know. There's multiple versions of the story of how he got cast for this. Like, no one can keep their story straight about how that happened.
It's like almost like a urban legend, you know, like, it's like, what's real, you know,
but the people that were all still alive and they were asking them, and they all still had a different story. Like, they were there. There's like the guy who ran United Artists at this point wanted Robert Altman to direct a picture, apparently. And then he said, I bet he'll work with us if I cast Elliot Gould. But then there's another story that he was on contract with United Artists for one more film. And then it was like, oh, you have to take Elliot Gould. And there's no one that can even account for whether they wanted Elliot Gould. Like, you know what I mean? Like, whether Elliot Gould was their choice. I mean,
Altman did work with him the next year. Like, they did California Split right after this. So, like, it went well.
Yeah.
You know? Especially because California Split is with a different studio, right? It's not with the United Artists.
Yeah, I think United Artists was done with Elliot Gould after that. Like, I think the contract part was real. But I don't know.
Well, so this wasn't a box office hit either. Like, I don't think UA was looking to get back in the Robert Altman business.
But then he would go on. I mean, Nashville was 2 years after this. Yeah. Like, I mean, then, you know, Popeye was 7 years after this. The most poked up film set, they've called it, of all time. So there's like, I don't know. He definitely had a crazy run, I think, in the 70s. I mean,
his 70s run is unassailable almost.
Yeah, with like McCabe, at least artistic, or whatever. He started with that movie, and they were filming in Vancouver, and he had the same kind of cinematographer, which I was watching his clips. The guy's so interesting, but I was watching his clips about he's like, oh, it's changed. People don't just sit around and watch dailies anymore. And I was like, so true, King. But yeah, like this movie is kind of, it's fascinating, and it's like, so
it's like before, the OG John Wick. He's doing all this for really a cat.
Is. Yeah. I wonder if John Wick was like kind of inspired, because they're kind of even dressed the same with like the suit and everything.
Yeah. I'm sure there's like scholar, you know, theses about this that I can look up if I
multiple
wanted to.
People got their doctorates based on that.
Keanu Gould theory, and they're like, listen, Reeves Gould sounds like a real medical condition that you can tell people you have. Like, oh, I've got Reeves. Like, I was reading the other day about Bogart Bacall syndrome, which is like, it's when you've done so much damage to your lungs that after a while of singing and like acting and stuff, that you get the Bogart and Bacall like a gravelly voice.
Like Lucille Ball then. Yeah, because a lot of people are like, what happened to her voice? I'm like,
or like Tom Waits.
Lucille Ball, she blew her voice out on Broadway doing a role that she clearly was not well equipped to sing.
Yeah. But, when you blow your voice out like that, it's called Bogart Bacall syndrome for whatever reason.
Nice.
But yeah, so I did this noir class, and I remember I really wanted to see this movie for the longest time. And see, I can't even keep my story straight. No, but so one of the things, we watched a bunch of different clips of this. Then we ended up watching Richard O'Brien.
Dark Passage.
No.
Dark Passage.
It's not Dark. I don't think it's Dark Passage. Hold on. Dark City.
This movie, okay.
Richard O'Brien's in it from Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah,
and it's like the futuristic version of a noir film. Mm-hmm. So our neo-noir film was that one. And I was like, come on, I really wanted to watch The Long Goodbye. And then I didn't get around to it till like 2021 or 2022. Kind of sucked.
I mean, you got around to it, though.
I did. And this is like, now I've gotten around to it like four times, and I watched it three more times in the last couple weeks. It's just so good.
It's so good.
Yeah.
There are few noir films that are, or neo-noir, that are this fun.
Yeah. I, and so much of it, I think, and we can talk about this, I guess, more later. I don't even know if like going through a synopsis would necessarily help because it's so like so many different sides to it.
Yeah, he's like Jordan the Stallion on all these different side quests. You know, instead of searching for going to places to eat food, which I could do that. He's doing other things. You
know? But like so much of I think what works about this and what makes it like a fun film, right, is like the improvised nature of it all. Oh, and it's you start to like, I don't know, like there is a script, obviously. Lee Brackett wrote it. We talked about how Lee Brackett also wrote the first draft of the Empire Strikes Back script. And for a very similar reason, it got, George Lucas basically gave her money. She was dying of cancer by that point, unfortunately. Yeah. And George Lucas gave her her money for it. But then he was like, I'm going to change all this stuff. And then he and his his writer went back over it and changed pretty much everything. I think she decided
died after the first draft was turned in. Yeah. I believe. Like before she could have ever effectively done a rewrite.
But he had the same kind of idea, like the same thing that Altman kind of did, where it's like, this is kind of a writer from another time, where it's like their version of whatever, you know, the story is. And she was really, she wasn't into this, but she had a lot of Westerns under her belt. Like she did Rio Bravo. She did a lot of the John Wayne ones and Howard Hawk ones that they did together. Yeah. So they basically had the same kind of thing where Robert Altman was like, I like a lot of the ideas in the script, like the ending that's so, I mean, it's like jolting when he shoots his friend after all that. That part of it, he shoots Terry, you killed Terry. That part of it was written by Lee Brackett, and that's why it feels so out of place almost, because it's like rewritten, which is funny that that's also how the Howard Hawks one that she had worked on, she worked on The Big Sleep with William Faulkner. So there's a version of her script, William Faulkner's script, Howard Hawks script, and one other writer, I think, who had worked on something like Casablanca or something crazy like that. And they all turned in their own version of the script. And then instead of like kind of, you know, formalizing it into one script, Howard Hawks is kind of doing it by the day. So both versions of this have a very improvised nature to them, which I think works pretty well with Raymond Chandler's subject matter, but not necessarily, I mean, writing style. It probably drove the guy insane when he saw The Big Sleep. He was not, I don't think he was a fan of it in the end.
right.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, like there are some times where you adapt something, you know, and it's like you do so many changes, but in the end it actually makes for a better story.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And we've seen this with quite a few movies, you know, and a lot of people are like, wow, I can't believe this was, you know, based off a book with all the changes. I mean, Mildred Pierce, for instance, is a good example.
Yeah.
They couldn't get away with all the incestuous crap in the 40s, so they made it a noir instead.
Yeah. That's another time when the person who wrote the person who wrote the original book hated the changes that they made, but then audiences would go and say, well, I actually like the changes that they made. So it's like, I don't know, I guess no author really wants their book changed that drastically. Although once in a while, I mean, like, maybe they do. But by this point, Raymond Chandler had drank himself to death, so it didn't really matter there.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's also some authors, and every once in a while you hear an author be okay with it, and they'll understand the changes that were made are because, you know, you're moving it to a different medium, and some authors can't divorce themselves from the like the particulars of the story that they wrote.
I'm pretty sure, I want to say Raymond Chandler had a Hollywood period though, right? We talked about,
yeah, because he wrote the script for Double Indemnity with Billy Wilder,
and I think there was one other really famous one that we were talking about that he had written as well. So he, like, I don't know, but he had the same kind of thing as Faulkner, where they were both they're both alcoholics who had basically burned out at some point and gone like, I can't do this anymore, and I can't write anymore, and literally gone through like this personal crisis that came both from
let me adapt The Big Sleep.
Yeah, I think both from like also just exhaustion, but also like alcoholism, like that was their moment where it was like, the more you can't write, which this movie covers really well, because I mean, Altman had the same problem, and so did Sterling Hayden, who, you know, plays.
Oh, yeah.
So he's improvising his own way through his own struggle with alcoholism pretty much, because just by this point, he just was too kind of, and he would end up quitting alcohol, I think, 4 years after this permanently, but then he'd die of cancer like 6 years after that or something crazy. Like,
well, yeah, he is very, very drunk in Ferris of Chaos or whatever.
Yeah.
I can't remember when exactly that shot. It came out in 83, but I think it came out a couple years after it shot, but holy shit, if you've ever seen that, Sterling Hayden is like trying to follow his trains of thought would drive someone mad.
I'm pretty sure it was like, yeah, it must have been, because I think he quit drinking. So I was reading this earlier. I think it was 4 or 5 years before he passed away. And then like, okay. So basically he quit drinking, lost a ton of weight, and then realized like he had cancer and passed away from cancer, which he had like these insane personal struggles. Like he had informed at one point during the Hollywood 10 thing. And he were like, cause he was a true believer. He was a leftist, but it just got to be like, the pressure got to be too much of him. I mean, yeah. I'm sure they had stuff on him because he was a crazy alcoholic. So he actually retreated from public life for the longest time and moved out of the country because he was so broken by what he did. I mean, it's one of the few people that really felt like, you know, like they had like that real personal crisis. It's not like Elliot Kazan or whatever, where it's like,
I was about to say that. Cause yeah. I mean, you know, everyone's like, who got a lifetime achievement award, the Oscars, and some people did not stand up for him. And a lot of people like, oh my God. And that was a
divisive award.
Yeah. It's like, you traitor to Hollywood. Let's reward you with like, well, yeah, you made a few good movies, but like, you still, man, what the fuck?
Also,
you're turning people who are more popular than you. No offense, but like,
it's also possibly like, you know, I mean, it's like the end of the Cold War, right? Like, part of the whole thing is like, well, we're putting this behind us, and it's like, not that we've ever atoned for it because we won, so we're doing basically a victory lap, you know.
yeah, they really, I mean, the only thing that came out of it was Burl Ives becoming a Christmas legend with his songs that he recorded, but other than that, it's like, you know, I don't know. I'm sure there's videos that do deep dives on like the post, you know, Hollywood 10, Red Scare, like career of like, I mean, it took Charlie Chaplin like 20, over 20 years, 30 years to get recognized in Hollywood. I mean, him getting his lifetime achievement Oscar was an apology, if you will, too.
Yeah. I mean, there's like Dalton Trumbo is a good example. He was writing scripts for all of these really big movies, including Spartacus. He was working with like Stanley Kubrick, who obviously wasn't working in the US. He was working in Britain, but he was working on all these big movies. And then later on, they found out that all these movies had been written by Dalton Trumbo under a pseudonym. Yeah. It's kind of nuts. Like, and that was happening. I mean, like, you know, Spartacus is 1968. He's still like, that was when he was finally able to come out and say, like, it's me, Dalton Trumbo. I've been writing this whole time. And then I think a lot of people are like, yeah, we know that.
Surprise. Like, surprise.
Well, Nicholas Ray and Joseph Losey never even bothered to come back.
Yeah,
they stayed in Europe and kept making movies the way they wanted to.
I don't know if Sterling Hayden would have come back if it wasn't like people really wanted to have him. And like, it's really, I mean, it's great he came back. Like Dr. Strangelove, Jack T. Ripper, like that's one of the greatest roles I think.
Yeah,
you know, anyone's done. Like, so it's great that he came back, but he just had this like crisis after that where he had to leave. And that you have to imagine that worsened his alcoholism like to the nth degree. So a movie like this, which he says is his favorite role, you know, even after the fact, like he was saying like this is his favorite role because he felt like it was the most honest portrayal he had of an alcoholic.
Yeah, you know, when I was rewatching this, I forgot that basically Ratanya Alda is in this movie. She's known for playing Caroline in Mommy Dearest. She played the mom in the Amityville Horror, The Possession, the second movie. I forgot, and she actually wrote like a tell-all about her experience with filming Mommy Dearest, and she had not so pleasant things to say about Faye Dunaway, obviously, because who actually has pleasant things to say about Faye Dunaway when working with her?
Yeah, only the people watching her films.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's like, wow, network was so good.
And they just gave her the same first name. Like, it's crazy. Like, it's a, you know, Ratanya Sweet. Like,
yeah.
I mean, that kind of sounds like a Latin poor name. But how did the Arnold get involved in this movie?
Because
this
is one of the earliest.
Because I didn't know. I always, when I assume Arnold Schwarzenegger becoming a Hollywood actor, it starts like in the 80s. But no, he had a career
Hercules in New York
before. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like decades before. Like, I didn't know his film career started in the 70s.
Yeah,
he was Mr. Universe or whatever, or Mr. Olympus or whatever the fuck they called him. That was back in like the early 70s, right? Like 71 or something.
Yep.
Yeah. Wait, I don't know if you're, I don't know how loud this is going to be, but. After all, this is what I owe you.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, who I was introduced to as Arnold Strong, he was a friend of David Arkin's, and he had done Pumping Iron or some film before that. And so David says, can we use him as one of those hoods? And I said, well, sure, if he's a friend of yours. And I didn't know who he was, or nor did he. So we used Arnold in the film, but Arnold will never speaks of this film.
Hello there, what can I do for you?
I have an appointment with Mrs. Roger Wade.
This guy that played that part, Ken Sampson, I remember he came over to my office and talked to him, and he did all those imitations and kind of badly, you know. So I said, oh, good, you can play the guard and he can do all that, because we wanted all that Hollywood stuff in the picture. And he was great. He was terrific.
I recently was making acting in Ocean's 11, and at about 1:20 in the morning, where we were shooting, and all 11 of us were there, and Steven Soderbergh, the director of that project, came up to me and said, "When you put the ink on your face, was that an improvisation?" And I thought, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "The Long Goodbye." I said, "It would have come back to me." I said, "Well, yeah." You know, he said, I thought so in terms of behavior. I said, and I mean, Bob gives me the right. If I'm playing, I'm always in character. So now there I am in that situation, and I've got the ink on my hand. I'm acting and I'm playing. So, you know, and then I'm improvising. And Bob as is the boss. Therefore, I can say what I feel, and if Bob doesn't like it, he'll tell me and I won't say it. In terms of improvisation and film, you're pre-lit and the camera is set up in terms of focus and we're all rehearsed. But then, I mean, it's like even if I move forward here, I don't know whether I'm still in focus there. And most people have a sense of film craft, but there's nobody in this field that gives you and has ever given me the kind of freedom and range to express myself within the theme of the character that I play.
I love Elliot Gould's voice. It's so distinctive, so smooth and rich. Like I'm assuming if I look on his IMDb biography, his trademark will be exactly like what they describe his voice as. See, quirky nimbuses, towering height, very rich, deep baritone voice. Exactly. Also, I forgot David Carradine, Socrates, in this movie too. Poor guy, he died of.
We shouldn't
have any shame.
No, it was Ninja Assassins. Don't you? Are you not up for that? He was taken out by Ninja Assassins because he was investigating them like on his own.
Mm-hmm. That's part of the.
And it's so funny. He's not even the weirdest Carradine in his family, too. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
I like the idea that part of, like, the last 20 minutes of the Kill Bill complete edition that they just released, you know, like they're putting it out where it's both movies at once, and they're like, oh, we have 20 more minutes. The last 10 minutes is David Carradine putting that around. The Ninja Assassin's going. but Keith Carradine was really close with Altman, and so much of Nashville, so much of what works about that movie is like the music specifically by Keith Carradine, who just happens to be playing his guitar at a party that they had, like a cast party. And Altman goes, oh, what's that song? And he's like, it's the song I'm Easy. And he wrote it. And Altman just goes, yeah, you're playing that in the movie. And he's like, this is really personal to me. Like I wrote the song, and the character that he plays in the movie is like this like disgusting man whore that the whole movie keeps going into the room with other people. And he's like, that's not who I was. Mm-hmm. I was so disgusted by that character. And then Altman stole it, like took my song right out of it and made it like the centerpiece of this entire movie. And he's like, and I was really mad about that for the longest time.
Also, he died in Thailand, so I'm like, oh, he was not only did he die from erotic asphyxiation, he was probably doing some sex tourism too. Good to know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying he wasn't a sex tourist, but if you listen to what his family says,
he was taken out by the
assassinated. He was a freak. By ninjas.
But yeah, so David Arkin's the guy that plays Harry. He's the guy that plays like the guy that's following that's hired to tail Elliot Gould. That he's like, you know, he's almost doing like solicitation to where he's like, oh, I'm so happy that you're following me and it's you. And
yeah, he's been in a lot of Altman films too. Yeah. He's also another director that has like frequent collaborators in his films too. But I feel like not enough people talk about it because we're so like obsessed with like Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro, you know? Because I mean, still it's that new Hollywood era too happening in the 70s.
Yeah. Well, which he's very much a part of, just kind of in a different, he just wasn't in that friend group, which when you look at
sure, because he's so much older.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you look at why people, like the big four, right? Like, I mean, George Lucas, Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, like that little group were all friends. So they were all hanging out.
Well, because they went to USC together, most of them.
Yeah.
And so a lot of them worked for Corman too.
Yeah. They're all Corman's boys.
Yeah.
Which is funny.
Yeah, also, he was not related to, Alan Arkin or any of the Arkins that are well known.
That's what I was going to ask.
He did it all on his own. He's Arkin'd his way up the ladder.
Yeah, it's sad that he died by suicide, though.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
I love when he's following him at the house and goes up. He goes to peek over the fence and Gould pulls the gate open with him on it.
Yeah. Well, that whole sequence, right? Because he gets out of the car and he's following him around, and Gould tells him, you know, well, first he's looking at the girls, and Gould's like, "Hey, I'm going to this address." He gives him the address to follow him to, which is like a very old noir kind of thing to do. You know, you're fucking with the person that's following you. You're like, "Oh, don't worry, I'm going to this address," and then you lose them. But he doesn't lose him. He goes to the place, and then he's actually like following the guy in, and he's like, "No, you're not supposed to follow. You're supposed to stay in the car." Like if you follow me,
Walter Brennan bit was funny too.
Yeah, all of his impressions are funny. From the like the Barbara Stanwyck one cracks me up at the beginning. Where he goes, I don't understand. And it really works for some, but that also feels like a very Hollywood thing, like having these weird guys that kind of work in Hollywood, like they're the more working class side of it, and they're never gonna make it as anything, but they're working the gate or something, and you know they desperately hope one day a director or something will pull up and they'll be like, "I'm going to cast you in something."
Yeah. Well, and I mean, maybe that guy was a guy who worked gates. We don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe he worked Altman's gate and just did that. Cause that is Altman's house.
That's true. Yeah.
The Sterling Hayden's house is, or the Wade house is Robert Altman's actual house. I can't believe he let a production shoot in his own home.
I mean, I don't think he didn't do that in ones of his movies, right? Like this feels like for a lot of different people, starting with Raymond Chandler, that character, the Roger Wade, like the Roger Wade character, was very special because you know Raymond Chandler was a person who suffered from not just debilitating alcoholism but writer's block, and then Altman was someone who suffered from debilitating alcoholism, and Sterling Hayden was someone who suffered from alcoholism that was even more debilitating than the rest of them.
There's a bit of a pattern here.
Well, I think a lot of people channeled their personal pathos into this character, and it's like that's why it works so well as this kind of crazy, just completely like improvised role where he's like doing it really big, it's terrifying. His character, he snaps on such a dime, and that's such a true alcoholic, like you know, piece of shit domestic abuser thing where he's like, so, you know, at one second he's kind of soft and he's like, baby, and he's like, balls, baby, big old balls, and it's like, it's kind of funny.
So it's pretty great ass.
But there's something about it that the person starts, it's so manipulative, right? Like they can start off soft and they can repeat, and then you don't expect it. And then they know that you're not expecting it. And then they hit you with like something truly violent. And it's crazy that, I mean, it works that it's a 50s character and he's a man at a time. And it's kind of the best way to show that he's a man at a time. But he's almost has this like superhero levels of not recognizing domestic abuse when he sees them, when he sees that happening in front of him, like Philip Marlowe in this case. Cause he's like, oh, my friend would never do that. And it's like, I saw that guy for 1 second and I know that guy did it. Like,
right.
It's so funny. I mean, this movie does have like, it's like comedy, you know, it's just like the line delivery of it all too. It's like, oh, it's like, it's not meant to be funny, but it kind of does sound like it when you say it.
Well, I mean, it starts off very funny. Like, it starts off, yeah. You know, I mean, just even, like, reading the plot.
Things get dark real quick.
That was like,
is Cap being an asshole about food?
Yeah, that was like Private Eye. Philip Marlowe leaves his Los Angeles apartment to buy cat food. After he returns, his close friend Terry Lennox arrives and begs Marlowe for a ride to Tijuana, Mexico. Marlowe notices the scratches on Terry's face, and Terry admits he's in trouble. Like, just that description of it, right? Like, it's funny the way that they play it, but it's also kind of terrifying because it's like, you know, those scratches are from a woman. And he's like, oh, did your cat get you too? You're thrown into this moment where it's both, you know, it's both like the cluelessness and utter just kind of like loserishness of Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe, which is so different than the actual Philip Marlowe, you know, and like as written on the Raymond Chandler page. Like, and then immediately you're thrown back into this thing where it's like, it's been humorous like that, and it snaps again, and the police are arresting him and telling him that, you know, Terry, who we've just met but have no background to, like, how did he meet this guy? Where is this guy from? Why are they just kind of trading like dollar bills back and forth? And like, why did he just let this guy crash whenever? He's, I guess that's just what private eyes do, right? And it's like, the guy is like, oh, I need to escape to Mexico. He doesn't even think like... So, but then, you know, and then it goes back again to this kind of humorous thing where they're going all the way through his arrest process, and he's fucking with the cops, and the cops are fucking with him, which is where they take the line from the actual Raymond Chandler book, like one of the few times they do it, where he's like, the cop comes in, he's like, is this where you're supposed to say, I'm under arrest? And you say, like, he does that whole back and forth, which is like a real Philip Marlowe line.
Yeah. I'm halfway through the book. I wanted to finish it and did not in time. But I'm like 200 pages in, and I was like, oh yeah, that is 100% from the book. And it's, I mean, like, you've got source material like that. You don't go away from it. It's fucking gold, you know?
Yeah. But then they do stray so far away from.
Oh, I know. But like that scene.
Yeah. No, for sure.
That scene's going to play in whatever script you want. Like,
It's also such a noir thing, right? Where it's like you have the character almost describing to you what's going on, and it's like it's kind of coy and like satirical and kind of strange at the same time and dark. And it's like a guy just kind of ranting to you. And it's interesting that you're not even hearing his inner monologue in this. You're literally just hearing him rant to himself. And like,
hear his inner monologue aloud throughout the movie.
Like, yeah, but I'm saying, it's not like his inner monologue is, because they play with the
internal. It's like he's literally talking to himself.
Yeah. That's why. But and like you hear diegetic and non-diegetic music throughout it, and it does the same thing with his monologue, where it's like you're hearing his thoughts, but he's just talking, like he's saying them to himself. They actually put them into the actual film.
He's stemming, you know.
I mean, essentially, yeah. Maybe I have ADHD and he has ADHD. And that's why me and Philip Marlowe were like. But yeah, it jumps right from Eileen Wade hiring Marlowe to find her missing husband, which takes you to a totally different part of the thing, right? And he's not even picking up on the fact that they know each other, Terry Lennox and the Wades, really.
Yeah, because she lets slip that she knows him.
Yeah, like over and over again throughout their conversation.
More like letting it slip. It's like she's intentionally like, wink, wink, hello.
Yeah. So you have, you know, so he's going to find him at a rehab clinic, and you have like the very sinister doctor. I think in the book is far more sinister, but in this it's Henry Gibson. It's hard to make him too sinister, right? Like he's such a small little slight figure. But he breaks Roger Wade out of the Malibu treatment center essentially, and brings him back. And then you get the part where, you know, the local gangster Marty Augustine finds him and is demanding money. And it's like these things are so differently spaced out, I guess. And that is how a lot of, I think, noir stories are.
Like, and the source material, like the overarching, like the sort of bigger notes of the script are largely pulled, you know, directly from the novel also. But
yeah. Local gangster Marty Augustine and his henchmen visit Marlowe in his apartment. They rough him up and demand he help recover $3,500, $35,000, or $355,000. I'm so bad at reading them.
What's that with inflation, you know?
That would be insane with inflation because it's 1975. That Augustine hired Terry to deliver his associates in Mexico City. To underscore the threat, Augustine smashes a broken bottle into his mistress's face. Again, jump. Like, emotional and... like physical and tonal jump that really just like freaks you out.
It's like, whoa.
Once Augustine and his henchmen leave, Marlowe follows them to the Wade's house where he sees Aline and Augustine having a heated conversation. This leads him to conclude the Wades are connected to the Lennox's deaths. You think so, buddy?
Took you that long to figure it out.
Yeah.
It's 2.75 million right now.
Man.
Jesus Christ.
So yeah, so it's a lot of money.
If someone could donate $350,000 to this podcast, that would be great.
Or you know, do go back in time, do it in 1975.
Yeah.
Marlowe decides
to take the DeLorean back.
Visits them again. Roger worries that Aline no longer loves him. To deter Marlowe from competing for Eileen's affections, he boasts to Marlowe that Augustine owes him $50,000. I don't know how that's supposed to get Marlowe to not go after him.
Later, if someone could do even $50,000, that would be fine.
Later, Eileen says it's actually Roger who owes Augustine money. Marty Augustine is such a good, like, villainous kind of like hood name, right? Like,
yeah.
He was Marlowe, Italian in the book. It was
Yeah, well, he's very
Austrian.
he's extremely Jewish in this version of it.
Yes. Yes, very much so.
He's like, oh, I it's Friday. I'm supposed to be in the temple. Marlowe travels to Mexico, but the Mexican police stick to their story. He returns to Malibu, where the Wades are hosting a party. Dr. Verringer crashes the party, once again demanding payment and slapping Roger. Although Roger drunkenly insults him, he cannot stand being humiliated in front of his friends. He pays Dr. Verringer and ends the party. Later that night, he walks into the ocean to commit suicide. Eileen and Marlowe run after him, but cannot save him. The book, I haven't read the book, but my understanding is that Dr. Verringer is a much more sinister and like controlling presence in the.
Yes. Yeah. The facility, basically he had him in a soon to be sold. It was a sort of artist retreat of sorts. And he had him locked up in a closet or in a cabin by himself. And then it was just him and this weird, like, possibly gay cowboy character.
It's
strange.
Get up on that thing.
Yeah.
Save a horse.
I haven't seen Verringer's End yet, so I can't say how it ends up shaking out.
Yeah. Well, there's my understanding is that there's a whole like the thing that
but it's
in here.
The price is he's renegotiating while he's got him under lock and key. Like it's more of an extortion than it is in how it plays in the movie.
Yeah. But there's something almost hypnotic about the way that Henry Gibson's character like treats it, which it has to be because he's so much smaller than like the giant man that is Sterling Hayden. But there's something. What I was reading is that there's something to do with like basically controlling through dosing him with such large doses of psychiatric medication that he's basically susceptible to anything.
Right. Right. And there's also it's weird placing this at this point in time. There were a bunch of weird, long since debunked. Especially in the era of the book, but it's still happening in the early 70s, where it's long since debunked, like alcoholism cures that pseudo doctors, quacks, 100%. But that quacks around the LA area are like, you know, getting people to pay for that don't fucking work.
Well, I mean, think about even like something like the Manson family, right? Like during the 60s, like these things were all connected to the things where these people would go into these psychiatric facilities, which Charles Manson did multiple times. And
for petty crime and stuff like that. He was in jail too.
Like, I think he was arrested something like 27 times, rape for like insane crime, like crimes he should not be back on the street for, which is why there's a lot of theories about, you know, who really was Charles Manson. Like, there's an excellent book about it. And like, I don't know. There's a lot of probably excellent books about it.
How could a guy like that have so much charisma and influence? It's like, what? But then again,
There's a lot of stuff connecting him to MK Ultra and stuff like that, where it's like they're really like, they're in real life too. I mean, that is real life, but other stories too that happened throughout this time period. There's like proven documentation. They were taking these prisoners and just either electroshocking them or putting them on a bunch of different drugs and putting the acid, in their drink or whatever, not telling them.
I mean, the women said that, you know, he would give them more LSD to make them even more influenced while he maybe didn't even take it at all, just to, throw them off and, you know, have them more enthralled by him. Just so fucking stupid.
So hoping that Terry's still alive, Marlo theorizes that Roger was having an affair with Sylvia and killed her to hide his infidelity, forcing Terry to flee the country until Marlo can reveal the truth. He badgers Eileen, who reluctantly confirms this theory. Marlo asks the police. By the way, he does it like right in front of the cops. The cops are on like, one side of the beach. And he's like, no, we had nothing to do with this. And he's like, tell me the truth. And that's like the one time he actually gets intense about anything. Marlo asks the police to reopen the Lennox investigation. They dismiss the theory, but confirm that Roger met with Sylvia before going to rehab. I wouldn't even call it what he was in rehab. Rehab.
They try to make me go to rehab, and I said yes, yes.
By the way, Whitey Bulger was a victim of. He was not even that he was involved. He was an unwitting victim of the MKUltra experiments. So Marlo receives a goodbye letter signed Terry with a rare $5,000 bill enclosed. I didn't even know they made it. Like, I guess they probably don't, right? Like, I didn't check whether
they do.
They do.
A lot of money in here.
Well, okay, so they stopped making the $5,000 bill with James Madison on it in 1934.
Imagine if we had a $5,000 bill today.
Yeah,
and it was signed. It was a goodbye letter.
Donald Trump.
It was a goodbye letter from Jason Miles because we helped him get to Tijuana.
Oh God.
Marlo meets with Augustine in his office, where upon discovering the $5,000 bill, Augustine grows he's already suspicious, but yeah, they frisk him down pretty much with Arnold, who's doing this in front of him, and then the $5,000 bill falls out. I love the line where he says, see, when everyone takes their clothes off, people get honest. Augustine parades his bandaged mistress in front of Marlo and threatens to forcibly remove his genitals, but Terry's buddy arrives in the nick of time, quite literally. Augustine lets Marlo go and gives him the $5,000 bill for his troubles. That's nice of him. He didn't have to do that. Marlo glimpses Eileen driving away. He runs after her, but she does not acknowledge him. During his pursuit, he's hit by a car. He wakes up in a hospital, is given a miniature harmonica by a heavily bandaged man in a heavily bandaged patient in the next bed. Eileen has disappeared. I love his line. I've seen all your movies, and it's because he looks like the Invisible Man.
Yeah.
Either that or a mummy, you know, like either way it plays.
I love when there's like a scene in the movie, like an actor, and they're like, I've seen all your movies. It's like, that doesn't sound creepy at all.
I think he's referencing the Invisible Man being bandaged up, and then that would make sense that he's from the 50s. So he's like basically traveling time. That's the kind of thing that would be on, you know, Claude Rains would be.
That movie. So the 4K restoration clearly shows all the special effects now that you see it. It's like, oh, you can see the string and you can see the disc.
That's like when we talked about Wizard of Oz. And it's like, you know, they did the 4K restoration of the Wizard of Oz. And it's like, you literally see the paint on their faces now.
Yeah, the makeup, like it's the wig caps, it's bad. It's bad. I don't like it.
Marlo returns to Mexico where he bribes local officials with the $5,000 bill. See, it's good that he got that. The official admits that a man with another $5,000 bill pays him to fake Terry's suicide. Marlo finds Terry in a Mexican villa. It turns out that Marlo's instincts were wrong and the cops were right. Terry explains that while there was, in fact, a Lennox Wade affair, it was actually Terry who was sleeping with Aline. Roger discovered the affair, disclosed it to Sylvia, who confronted Terry. Terry then killed Sylvia during a violent argument. Terry gloats that no one cares about the case anymore since he's legally dead and Augustine got his money back. Marlo asks Terry why he framed him as a suspect, but Terry dismissively calls Marlo a loser. In response, Marlo fatally shoots Terry. That's not why he fatally shoots Terry.
Okay, Trump. What the fuck?
Because of the cat.
It's because of the cat. It's because he went through all that trouble.
This is fucking the OG John Wick, man. He's doing something for a pet that he loves dearly. Like, it's crazy. Because when I was rewatching this, I was like, because I hadn't seen it in a while, I was like, is this just John Wick, but for like cat lovers? Like, what's happening?
The name's Wick.
With Wick. Corey Cat Food as the official sponsor of the film.
Yeah.
And Coca-Cola, I think.
And the podcast.
And my sponsor.
Yeah. Did you guys wonder if Coca-Cola was a sponsor of the film? If there was product placement?
Product placement.
There is. Coca-Cola, break one of our bottles on your mistress's face. It's so good.
And have two dogs hump in front of the sign, right? Or just off to the side from the sign.
I don't know how they got the dogs to act the way they did, but they have some like incredible dogs.
I don't think that was acting.
I think
it was happenstance, right? We got two dogs in heat. Let's go.
But they also had a coyote run past the dog, and then the dog chased the coyote. And I don't know, like
I love that he called the dog Asta.
Yeah,
I mean this is not Toto level acting, you know? Like,
yeah,
the cat did Toto level acting.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
Man, what a great picture cat.
The MVP.
You can teach a new cat new tricks, but you can't teach an old dog new tricks, you know?
Yeah, can we get a shout out for Morris the cat?
Yes.
Hell yeah, Morris the cat. Wait, hold on. Say it again.
Can we get a shout out for Morris the cat?
there's too many effects on StreamYard at this point. There's like, it takes me so long to find each level of it.
Yeah, he was the advertising mascot for Nine Lives Cat Food, and plus he was also in this movie and in the Seamus with Burt Reynolds and Diane.
Seamus is great. I love Seamus.
I haven't seen that movie in a while.
I went through a pretty heavy Burt Reynolds phase.
I mean, you know, you can do where
he died in 1993.
Morris did?
He lived a good life.
Holy shit.
He was like, you know, that's
21 years after this.
He was like,
yeah,
he was like,
simple meow and all this deaf is.
He was like, you don't know me, but in the 70s, I was a big deal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm old enough to remember Morris the cat in the like Nine Lives commercials. But like this was Morris the cat was like the cat on TV from my childhood. He was in all the ads.
Garfield was the cat on TV during mine.
You love lasagna, Forrest, and you hate Mondays.
So I found these interviews that the Vilmos Siegmund, who was the Hungarian, he made it to 85. He was the Hungarian cinematographer behind Altman's stuff in the 70s. And there were these like very interesting. So it's two parts, and one of the parts is a little bit longer. But this is a talk he gave on his shooting style, and I thought it was interesting how much Altman's use of the zoom kind of was like a big deal that you don't really, you know. I mean, like a lot of there's so many filmmakers that are inspired by Altman. Like he's like I mean, even you know, of course, Paul Thomas Anderson. Like
sure.
So basically, I love to work with directors, and I love to work with production designers. Altman's movie looks so different from each other, it's amazing, like somebody else did it, you know. So he required that also from his cinematographer to come up with ideas, and we certainly did come up with ideas with Robert, you know, from the beginning of shooting McCabe and Mrs. Miller, when we developed actually the flashing technique. And there was a scene, for example, on the beach in a big party scene where Altman said, what can we do here? Can we create a little bit this golden Hollywoodish look? And I jokingly, I said, you know, because I didn't really believe it the first time and I said it, that, well, Robert, why don't we just flash 50%? He says, that's right, that's a great idea. And I was stuck, you know, with this idea because it's very difficult actually to shoot something, you know, with that kind of a flashing, because flashing adds so much gray into the film and you lose the contrast. And you know, in order to get an acceptable image, I had to overexpose a little bit the film. So that was, the flashing technique already was invented when we did the Long Goodbye, basically. But we always have to create a different mood for a different story. And that can be done in many, many ways. With lighting, with flashing the film, with pushing the film, like increasing the contrast in the film. Today's style is a little bit different than in the old days. You know, it was interesting that today's style almost goes back to the old technical days. You know, I find the colors and the contrast very harsh today in movies. And it's not really my liking, you know, this style of today. So if I would do another movie, probably I will look into flashing again. I think in the future it might even happen that people will get tired of this contrasty look, and we'll go back again to something more natural. No. Moving the camera, that depends a lot of times from the director. And many directors actually set their camera angles, set their camera moves, and enjoy doing that. Because this is part of their strategy also, that how they actually stage the actors, how they move from point A to point B. That's part of it, where the camera has to be at that time. And with Robert also, you can add also one more thing to it. He loves the zoom lens. He really invented to shoot with zoom lenses. I don't think that before Altman there was any feature where they used the zoom lens so much. And he didn't even mind sometimes to use the zoom and make it look like it's a zoom. So he incorporated this style in his movies, which later on, myself, I used it a lot. And with many, many directors who hated the zoom lens, I still use the zoom lens by telling them and proving to them that you use the zoom lens, but you don't have to make it look like you are using a zoom lens. It's a help, actually, because I can build actually a dolly track parallel to the set, and when I'm dollying from left to right, for example, at one point I start zooming in into a person, it makes it look like it's a diagonal dolly and not like, you know, a parallel dolly. And nobody will know the difference. I mean, you can really watch those shots really to...
Such a soft-spoken guy.
Insane list of films. I come in real hot. You know, a year before this, Deliverance, he had done, which we did our episode with Mark Borchardt about Deliverance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't know that.
Are you a fan too?
Yes, obviously.
Man, he also did,
there are so many people who are, when we mentioned that, they're like, actually, oh my God.
He actually liked
Letter Hack.
He liked both posts for this episode that we put up.
Yeah.
Nice. Where nice. We talked, because he's still, because he's really close with Conan, because he did, sometimes he's in the chat.
That makes sense. Okay. Yeah. I was like, yeah.
He does some of
in Milwaukee.
Yeah. He's an awesome, yeah. Sweet
guy. He does Conan's music videos. A lot of them. He directs a lot of Conan's. Yeah. So McCabe and Mrs. Miller, obviously, which is the other Altman film from around this time. The Deer Hunter. The Sugarland Express, a year after. Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Ooh. Like,
Black Dahlia. He did the Spielberg documentary where it was like Spielberg or whatever.
Wait, Black Dahlia as in like the fucking Brian De Palma movie?
Yep.
Oh,
and then he kind of went a little bit downhill into Jersey Girl with Kevin Smith. He was
in defense of Jersey Girl. I mean, they tweet Tom, what everyone else did cast. Okay,
you're literally a Jersey Girl.
But I was raised in South Carolina. But I'm just saying, the only good thing about fucking Jersey Girl was George Carlin telling Ben, "We're gonna take her to see the cats."
These lists go for, it was the two Jakes, the Jack Nicholson movie, yeah. Robert Duvall as Stalin. there's this list of movies is crazy. It was all over the place. So really,
I also wasn't joking in the chat. I said 24 episodes of the Mindy Project, which he did.
Oh, shoot.
Damn!
He also shot apparently like the HBO mini, the Stalin HBO mini series or whatever, like. Insane all over the place guy, but this crazy uses of the zoom lens I can think of in all of Altman's films that I've seen, but one of them is Nashville kind of uses it to like, and then he didn't do the cinematography for that, but Altman uses the zoom lens to kind of create like a documentary feel throughout Nashville. Mm-hmm. And like you can see his use of, but then here they use it really well when you know, all the scenes were kind of Philip Marlowe's spying on pretty much everybody, which is, he's a private eye, so it's his job. Not hating on it, not hating on a player for that, but you can kind of see it when he's either looking at arguments between the Wades, or you could see it when he's watching the Wades meet with Marty Augustine. Like, there's all these moments where he's kind of just spying on them, and you could see that zoom lens really being used to, like, its full effect.
Yeah. I love that shot when the Wades are arguing inside and Marlo is on the beach.
Yeah.
And you can see Marlo in the reflection of the window as the Wades are arguing. And he's like, Elliot Gould is basically like playing chicken with the waves that are coming in with the tide. Like, that's such a great shot.
Yeah, well, it showcases like the complete childlikeness of his character versus, you know, you're literally watching an alcoholic scream at his wife, and his wife, they're having like the most dramatic fight about his, like, the future of their marriage and the alcoholism, and then you just see Philip Marlowe basically skipping on the beach.
Yeah.
He also did the entirety of Heaven's Gate, like the 3.5 hour long western that the guy from the Deer Hunter did.
Oh, not most the cult? Importantly.
Yeah, he didn't shoot the cult's exit. Most importantly, he shot.
Sometimes when you're shooting the cult leaves this world. You want to make sure that you have the exact right lighting.
Most importantly, he shot Real Genius.
There's so many. There's like, he became associated with leading American directors Robert Altman, Steven Spielberg, Brian De Palma, Michael Cimino, and Woody Allen.
Woody Allen, is he not married to what's her face, who's in the Epstein files?
Woody Allen is all over the Epstein files. Yeah,
that's true.
Woody Allen was Epstein's next door neighbor. Yeah. So he was always at his house.
Oh, Jesus.
There's a whole thing about that. But
you know what? I hate when they talk shit about Mia Farrow, and I'm like, she wasn't. I mean, granted, she was friends with Roman Polanski, but like.
But she wasn't in the Roman Polanski files.
The files.
You know, he also did The Crossing Guard, the Sean Penn directorial movie. There's some very interesting things that he did in this career. But I like that the television is the Bold Ones. And he did an episode of like the 1969 Bold Ones series or whatever, The Mists of Avalon, which I've never heard of, and then The Mindy Project.
Yeah. Those are the three on, I mean, there are probably more credits that just aren't on his Wikipedia page, but it's very funny that those are the three that are on the Wikipedia page.
De Palma's Blowout. Yeah. That's another one that he did. Another neo-noir movie that he did.
Mm.
You wanna hit it with Letterbox one-liners?
Yeah. So Letterbox is a place where film lovers, film haters, and film curious folks, they gather with each other to discuss the films they love, the films they did not love, the films that they thought, hey, this guy, he's just cool. He's just a cool guy. And they love smoking and love cats, apparently. This is expressed on Letterboxd, a platform that we all know and love. And honestly, with this bit, we should be getting a lot of credit for doing Letterboxd because we did it first.
Yeah, they literally have directors now just read Letterboxd like one-line reviews of their movies. And it's like we had Slim on here who does their social media and did that bit. And then right after that, we started noticing the bit pop up.
Yeah. So again, it's not just a Siskel and Ebert's or whoever wants to read them of the world. Bottom of democracy, as Conan puts it. But here are the Letterboxd one-liners from The Long Goodbye.
And it happens every day. Letterboxd.
There is no surface on Earth that Elliot Gould can't use to light a match.
The most impressive one is as he walks into the grocery store. He uses the grocery store shelf to light a match.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I love it.
I'm just like, if that goes wrong, the whole grocery store is going up, and you're not getting any cat food. This is L.A. Like, this is where the wildfires are.
I know. You gotta be careful there, bud. Coolest guy in the world. Also, the ADR in this is insane, but it's okay with me.
It takes a little bit to like,
yeah,
because the entire first 10 minutes is re-ADR, and you could tell. Because it's like they don't even bother to make it match up with because he had the cigarette in his mouth, so you can't really see his mouth move anyway.
Wow.
Then he's like real up close. He's like way more up close than he would be. So he's like I'm gonna go do current brand cat food. And he's cat. And then he has some line where he's like there's a lot of hungry tigers in the world in India, and they're just killing them. And he's like, well, you didn't like my thing about tigers in India.
the cat propaganda in this movie is crazy.
Yeah, except when the guy says, "What I need a cat for? I got a girl."
Yeah, seriously.
But I mean, he ends up
one way or the other.
Just like cats. If you don't got a girl,
I love cats. Few movies that pulled off guy talking to himself this well.
Imagine. I hate what I'm about to say.
Uh-oh. Say it.
Imagine if they reshot that whole scene, but it's James Corden's cat.
with or without the butthole.
Oh no, with the butthole.
Okay.
And he's like, but I couldn't believe that James Corden would turn down food, so maybe that doesn't work.
Yeah, right.
Could watch 6 hours of Gold Marlowe tooling around LA, chain smoking cigarettes, and being an asshole to everyone but his ungrateful cat.
And the cat scratches him. The cat goes to town on his shoulder, and he's like, still like, oh, well, I guess I just gotta get a different kind of food. He's never like, hey, cat, fuck you. Ow.
No, it's funny. This reminds me of the time Sam Cedar, because Sam Cedar is a cat man, which I love and I appreciate that. He was talking about how his cats, you know, aren't going in the litter box, or like they go like in the, you know how some cats go like in the far corner and it's like, what the hell? And they get gunk everywhere. And yeah. I'm like, change the litter. And apparently still did make a difference.
what I need a cat for, I got a girl. But she's going in the corner.
I wonder how much of his dynamic with his cat, though, is because the cat's his abuser.
I could go for that spinoff. That like a mini part, like a dark, like mini series about the cat, him, the relationship. You know,
well, yeah. the cat's essentially his abuser, and then he's like all other abusive throughout this film is like completely invisible to him, right? Like he seems to kind of become submissive to the abuser throughout the story, where he just. He does the same thing like a woman would do with her, like, well, like you don't know him, he's got some good qualities. When someone's being abused, you're trying to like, you know, you're trying to convince them.
He's had a hard life, what, who cares.
I'm fascinated by the sexlessness of this movie, like, because it's the opposite of The Big Sleep.
Oh, you're saying Gen Z would love this movie?
But it's the opposite of The Big Sleep, where everybody is trying to constantly fuck Philip Marlowe. And in this movie, every woman is kind of, I mean, not repulsed by him, but treats him like kind of a gay friend that's they're comfortable talking to, but there isn't like sexual chemistry. I mean, Elliot Gould is obviously hot as fuck during this time, but it's like,
yeah,
it's interesting that they decided to kind of make him this almost sexless character.
Yeah, he's a eunuch, like, basically.
Yeah, and there's the women. Who else
would love him then?
There's like all these women that are just literally topless doing yoga constantly, and he's not even really looking at them. He just kind of takes it for granted at some point that, like, which I guess you would if you're kind of in that situation and you're almost desensitized to it. But
yeah, if that was your life every day,
and it happens every day,
but like, every creep who comes to his place, is completely distracted at all times by that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So it's like he's almost like. It's almost like he's the most clear-eyed about stuff in some ways, because he's not sexually, it seems like, charged by those. He's just kind of mildly annoyed that they're high and they keep asking him for things. So maybe incels would love him.
Single-handedly set back the quitting smoking movement by 150 years.
I mean, look, you know, smoking at some point, right, makes your dick not work. Maybe that's what's going on.
I mean, he literally chases after a car that is driving down like this boulevard in Westwood with a cigarette in his mouth the whole time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I remember like first time I watched this, feeling like at the point where he leaves Marty Augusty's house, I'm like, well, they kind of wrapped a lot of stuff up, and then you sit by the car, and I'm like, well, there we go. Yeah, and what's gonna happen? Are they gonna introduce a whole another set of characters?
Yeah. It's fun watching old home movies of my sister, like the first birthdays and Christmases she had, and it's just my parents and all the adults in the room just smoking a cigarette and blowing smoke in her face, and I'm like,
yo, people used to do that. But this is the 70s though, and they were already kind of having like it's California, right? Like they're kind of already having the beginning, I guess, of the anti-smoking movement.
And the fitness fad, yeah.
Like only Marlowe, who's supposed to be a guy transported from the 50s, is constantly chain smoking. Not to say he's the only one that does chain smoke or that does smoke in this movie, but he's the only one that chain smokes, right? Everyone else is kind of,
Yep. I want Elliot Gould to breathe on my face.
Well, there's someone that just quit smoking. What? It's not if it's not smoking if he just blows it in my face.
True. I'll be honest, this made me unbearably horny throughout, but hey, it's okay with me.
But like, it's fascinating to have a movie that's the main character
sexless is sexless and make sexless, you horny. Yeah.
I mean, you could think of like, I feel like a movie like this could be made today with like Ryan Gosling, right? Like,
yeah, in a way where and it's his, like, where it's and like his women balloon are like, face. God, stop women, with the fillers.
Yeah, but I'm saying like women are attracted to him, or you know, or women that watching the film, not in the film, because in the film they have to act like he said, but like women watching the film are very attracted to him, but like an order of sexlessness in that role and like vulnerability, I guess, around women.
Yeah. I wish I owned a suit.
I like watching this movie. That's the conclusion you come to. And you're like, I bet I look good in the suit.
Yeah.
I bet that person also had like a little bit of a Jufro, like Elliot Gould did at this point. They're like, so they have like the nice curly hair, and they're like, I bet I would look great in a suit if it sure, was just right, a suit right, and right. It was like my curly hair.
Mm-hmm. So, those are Letterboxd one-liners for a long goodbye. Forrest over there, always Flacco. He's logging a bunch of stuff all the time. And also on the Movie Night Extra account, he's also logging usually what we're discussing, doing like summaries and all the good stuff, extra content. We love it. Josh, you're over there on Letterboxd too, right?
I sure am. I'm Old Man Dugan.
Yeah. You can find me smoking kills. At Christina on Letterboxd. And
it would be pretty funny if that was if you rebranded to Smoking Kills.
Yeah.
you're an anti-vaping advocate from now on.
Yeah, okay.
Get just ready for my out with Grover Norquist.
Yeah. Get ready for my Wicked for Good review.
Oh yeah, that's in 2 days, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's coming up quickly. There's so many promotions. I'm like, I saw your thing where you posted a guy it was going to like Chili's or something. There's like a Wicked Chili's.
Yeah,
drink
they got
or whatever.
The drinks.
Yeah, but
Wicked was divisive between the three of you, right?
No, I think we all enjoyed it. The thing is, Conan doesn't
like musicals.
Yeah, isn't a musical fan.
Yeah.
He ended up liking it, but okay. Not as much as Christina.
Okay. All right.
It would have been bad if it was, I think, pretty divisive. But let me.
I think it's fun when there's some butting of heads on movies.
Yeah, but I don't know if everyone in the moment.
We're all strong personalities. It would be very bad.
Yeah. So we have different like ideas about some movies. But if one person really hates it, it kind of bums everyone else out. If everyone else loves it, somehow it always turns out like that. Where it's like it's only one person that is on a panel that like hates it, and everyone else loves it, and it's like.
It was like when KT, we had her on for The Wizard of Oz and Nosferatu, and we were like, oh.
You did not like them. But
I didn't like Nosferatu either, but.
I enjoy
the Eggers one, right? Like, I like the Murnau one.
Yeah.
But.
I don't know. I thought it was. We could have a whole conversation about this.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's
Gothic Horror is back. Anyway,
I don't think everyone likes Gothic Horror. I think that's part of it, right? Like the
yeah, a lot of people are expecting like cheesy CGI now, and I'm like, come on, man.
I'm okay with Gothic Horror. I just thought it was incredibly boring, and I hate Aaron Taylor Johnson so much.
I mean, that's understandable.
You're not gonna like Werewolf.
Yeah, Werewolf is gonna be him as the werewolf. The
he looks like he could be a werewolf.
Can they stop trying to make him happen? It has
wife is director.
Apparently Robert
his wife is a director. I mean a predator. What? So both, that's why they're trying to make it happen.
But his wife wasn't in any of the Predator movies. Weirdly enough. Yeah. All right, let's hit it with the old plugs.
If you're watching us on YouTube, please like and subscribe. And then hit the bell to get notified whenever we're streaming. And we'd humbly request that you watch the video to the end because it helps us with the algorithm and helps more film fans to discover the show. We're also monetized. If you want to get your chat questions definitely read on stream, you can always send us a super chat, which will help us keep the show going. Every cent helps. If you're watching on Twitch, you can gift us a free sub on Amazon Prime with your Prime membership,
but getting subs on Twitch is always appreciated, and it helps to follow us on there as well. We also have an audio feed, which is available wherever you download podcasts, if you prefer to listen to podcasts rather than watch the stream. That's updated usually the same day we stream, but watching on YouTube and Twitch is the best way to get the show first, live as it happens. If you want to support us with a monthly donation and get access to all of our after parties forever, which go patron only after we do them, you can become a patron at patreon.com/movienightextra. Link is in the description for that. It really helps us keep the show going since we do have some expenses to make this happen. We also have a Discord community. Link is in the description for that. We sometimes watch movies we cover on there. We get into conversations about everything from film to TV shows to related podcasts. We even have a Discord channel for memes. It's really fun on there. You can find us on all the social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, Twitter, and Threads. You connect with us on all of those. Talk to us. We'd love to hear from you. Lastly, we recently made a TikTok at Movie Night Extra, where we're putting up short-form clips from the episodes. Okay, passing this to Conan so he can tell you about his music and this week's Protonic Reversal. Conan, who's on Protonic this week?
No, so Protonic, Conan is on he's on tour. So November 19th, so tomorrow, he's going to be in Wichita, Kansas at Kirby's Beer Store. November 20th, it just says TBA, but he's in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And November 21st, he's in Phoenix, Arizona. I feel like the Wichita one might have gotten switched around because it doesn't really make sense with the rest of his tour if he's in he's in Texas right now. So at the very least, he's going to be in Santa Fe, New Mexico on the 20th and Phoenix, Arizona at Overdue on the 21st. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, Christina, what you got going on?
Well, I had my show today, and I just found out that the South Carolina anti-abortion ban, the anti-abortion bill that they were going to, did not pass. Thank God. We have to wait till April for them to bring it back up. All men, all male politicians who were responsible for that bill being a thing. Rapists can sue their victims for getting an abortion. And that is weird. Apparently the rapist doesn't even get much jail time, but the woman would for like decades, and curtailing in vitro fertilization. It's just all the usual stuff, but it's even more restrictive than like most of the other states that have done their own abortion bans, which is stupid.
I feel like that's where they keep fucking up. Like they felt like they got too much wind in their sails after, you know, the Supreme Court was like, oh, we're just gonna do it state by state, and every Republican legislature is like, oh, we've got wind in our sails, we could do this, and they're like, so we're gonna put the woman away for like life. What do you guys think about that? That every state's like, no, that's horrifying. Don't do that in vitro.
Yeah. Like, yeah, and also too, letting the rapist sue. It's like, you're not gonna let the rapist not go to prison for committing the crime. No, the real crime is aborting that precious life. Like, no.
Trump's like that law sounds fine. Let's do it.
Yeah, he's sounding rough these days. He's like, I was yelling to people about trade in Venezuela or whatever. I'm like, I don't believe that. You're yelling at people about the Epstein shit. Also, the Senate 100-0 voted to release the files, and I'm still finding this to be very suspicious.
Yeah, it's gonna have some real redactions, I bet.
It's gonna be all black marker. It's gonna be bad.
Remember Epstein was talking to blank about blank, and he said blank.
About blank. Well, yeah, that's while he was vacationing in blank. Also, I was streaming for a long time yesterday because I decided to do my annual Jonestown Massacre retrospective stream, and a lot of people were impressed with my knowledge on the subject. Also, shout out to Leslie Wagner Wilson. She has a podcast called Black Jonestown. If there's a group of people who often get ignored when it comes to this, is the actual victims, who are majority black. So she has a YouTube channel, Black Jonestown. First episode dropped, highly recommend. And she makes parallels to Donald Trump, which I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Jim Jones was just Donald Trump before Donald Trump was Donald Trump. Also, Forrest and I are starting a podcast.
Yeah, we're going to start one on Thursdays on this space. Time to be announced. Not quite sure what time, but I think it should be later in the day. Excited about that. Gonna get to talk about politics, which I'm gonna sneakily sprinkle in movies, and then people are gonna be like, oh, where can I hear you talk more about movies? And then I'm like, oh. Yeah. Hell yeah, on the same channel, but just on this space, but on Tuesday.
Yeah. And also after I'm done stream, after I see Wicked on Thursday, I will be doing a live stream review, because I'm going to be an emotional wreck. Expect my eyes to be just red and watery and swollen.
And then you say, no, it's the wicked drink. They put hot sauce in the drink and it got in my eyes.
Ah! Oh man, it's gonna be interesting.
No, the movie was too bright and it got eyes. Josh, what you got going on?
I Munch by Benson's dropping new episodes. We're back fully.
Hell yeah.
Unkind Rewind season 3 is done. Season 4 should be we're ramping up to start recording season 4 pretty much right now. I've got like 4 different guests that corresponding with, in addition to Christina whenever she gets us her list.
I again, most movies I've seen from my childhood that matter to me, I've seen again.
You gotta go over movies that don't matter to you.
Yeah,
clearly.
So both are presumably of at least mild interest. Munch My Benson's a weird podcast, but I don't know, whatever. We're
gonna get Jimmy Kimmel on. God damn it.
I know. We got to get Kimmel on. I would be remiss. I do have a past internet life as a baseball writer. I would be remiss if I didn't mention Jim Bowden, of course, wrote Ball 4, one of the best baseball books ever. He was a former pitcher for the Yankees. And so when he doesn't know Joe of the DiMaggio brothers, that's funny because Joe DiMaggio was the Yankees great, yeah. And Dom weren't. So that's a little inside baseball moment. Jim Bowden also was the co-founder of Big League Chew and made more money off of Big League Chew than he ever did as a baseball player.
Mm-hmm. Before I ask final thoughts, I wanted to say, and I'll put it in the description for this episode, but I should say that Leslie Lee, who we've had on for multiple episodes, including the last Oscars one that we did, passed away of long COVID. And there is a GoFundMe for that he originally put up, but his wife gets the donations and she's donating them to like the fight with long COVID and for his expenses. So I'll put that into the description. It's very, very sad. And you know, even as far back as March from when, you know, even like long before that, but like in March when we had him on, like he had to bail out after an hour because he felt sick. So it's like his fight with, you know, long COVID was extremely rough. So yeah, I'll put that in the GoFundMe. You know, very sad that he passed away. He was great. He was great on everything that he was on. Did a lot of stuff with Katie Halper. I think she's, you know, it hit her pretty like very hard. Like long before I knew him, I was working for her, and I felt like when I actually had a conversation with him, like I felt like I knew him already, and I had to be like, "Listen, I basically feel like I know you because I've been editing clips like for hours, hours, hours at your end." Mm-hmm. But yeah, now that I've, you know, brought it in a completely different direction, Josh, long goodbye. Final thoughts.
I mean, I really just I love this movie so much. It's so fun. It's so like so metatextual with like, you know, nods to Jim Bowden being a baseball player. It's sort of this weird time, you know, like they name drop that Marty Augustine lives across the street from Richard Nixon. And this is like right at the moment in time where is that a good thing? you know, like Watergate's going nuts, like, you know, Nixon's 17 months from resigning, but he's definitely like embroiled in scandal. It's such an interesting time for this thing to be set. And it's, I love LA around this time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just so, it's so fun seeing like LA and not just some movie that was shot on the lots, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and there's like this, like around this time, right? Because of all the Watergate stuff, because of all the corruption stuff, they really just rediscover noir in a big way because it's like that same vision that kind of they were started to have.
Very political.
The late 40s, early 50s with McCarthyism and, you know, like all of this paranoia, Cold War paranoia kind of comes back, but it's in a very different, you know, it's in the American domestic
term rather than
the, yeah. Christina, final thoughts.
This, ironically, is probably one of the best cat propaganda movies out there. Honestly, like, regardless of, you know, the cat being the abusive one in the relationship here.
I mean, isn't
the cat always, though? Yeah. But I really like this film. It's a really great Robert Altman film. Like, if you're going through, like, a Robert Altman, like, phase, or, you know, you cannot miss this movie. I mean, you can miss Popeye if you want, I guess, but, like, this is, like, you cannot...
You started out having a Robert Altman phase, now you're having a cocaine phase. That's when we're
popping. Yeah, exactly. Something's going on. Something's going on. But yeah, as Elliot Gould at his best, you know, post-Streisand divorce, I mean, he's hot, he's young, you know, it's great. I highly recommend it. Also, love to the cat, the real MVP of this movie.
Next week, we're finishing out our, basically finishing out, we kind of are going to bleed the 2 months into each other with films about movies and our noir month. But next week, Big Lebowski.
Very That's like your opinion, man.
And very excited. We're going to have Letter Hack on to talk about that with us.
Nice. Yeah.
Old Matt Strachbian, our good friend. So, tune in for that. And yeah, the Long Goodbye. Amazing. And the improvised nature of it, right? It's like, how many movies are this good that managed to do that? I mean, I feel like the number is, that isn't straight comedy, right? Like,
right.
Yeah. Incredible.
Especially with so many so many long takes, you know, like you're not just like doing like, oh, let's get five alts and we'll just take the best one. No, it's not that. This isn't like heavily cut. Like, so many movies that are heavily improvised.
You know what's funny? A movie that did do that over and over again, Dr. Strangelove. Like, you know, pretty much they just said, all right, do a version of this, do a version of this, do a version for this. That movie does not really feel improvised as much. No. But, like, big portions of it are. So that's, like, another interesting version of that. But still, that's, like, you know, straight-up satire. And this is, like, neo-noir / mystery / satire. It's like,
right.
This movie manages to be serious about things at times. Some pretty intense times.
With the ending? Yep.
Yeah. Usually I would say after party, but I've got a cold and my voice is just going to break in one second. So we will see you next week. Conan will be back talking about The Big Lebowski, you know, and see you next week. Catch you on the flip.